And our special guest, L.A. Marzulli, you heard what we're talking about, these elongated skulls in Peru. Chime in. We'll take your calls when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with L.A. Marzulli. L.A., would you say this discovery was probably the highlight of your career so far?
Well, that's, you know, it's kind of a toss-up, because what we discovered in episodes 4 and 5 in America Stonehenge just blew me away. That's why number 5 is called the Axis Mundi. All those connection points between America Stonehenge and all the other sites globally, which that just absolutely blew me out of the water, because it shows us that everything is connected. And when I talk about that, let me just briefly go there, just briefly.
Sure.
Because it's sort of a toss-up between what we just, once again, it's real hard science. We're out there doing stuff. So in America Stonehenge, Kelsey Stone and Dennis Stone, Dennis is the curator of the museum and the owner of the property now, they discovered if you go out to the summer solstice standing stone, so you're in the center of the henge, you're in the center of their site, you go out to the summer solstice standing stone, you see that sun come up. So no one thought anything of it. Okay, there's the sun. So what? So it's cool. It comes up over that standing stone. So you could do that. You know, you just wait for the longest day of the year and then put that stone there and you're done, right? But Kelsey Stone, 23-year-old college student at the time, goes on Google Earth because he wants to just see, well, I wonder where the line goes. What if I draw the line from the center of America Stonehenge out to that standing stone where that sun comes up? Wonder where it goes. So he goes on Google Earth and he does this, and he extends the line, and he's over Nova Scotia, out in the Atlantic, over Ireland, and now he's in southern England, and he begins to zoom in a little bit. And that line, George, intersects the center trilithon in Stonehenge, England. But wait, it gets better. And this is revealed in the Axis Mundi. There are other standing stones on the property. This information has been hidden literally for 4,000 years, for thousands of years. No one knew about the connectivity between these sites until Dennis Stone sort of piggybacked on Kelsey Stone. Well, there's other standing stones on the site. The winter solstice, the rising and setting of the sun, the equinoxes, the lunar standstills, and all this is embedded in America Stonehenge in New Hampshire, Salem, New Hampshire. So they started to go out and do the same thing, go on Google Earth, go out to the winter solstice standing stone. Remember, no one has ever done this before, because the Google Earth hasn't been around for more than, what, 20 years at the most?
Exactly, exactly.
And so they go out and they start tracing the lines. It intersects to Chaco Canyon, goes right to the heart of Chaco Canyon, New Mexico. Another standing stone goes right to the Pyramid of the Moon in Teotihuacan, Mexico. Another one traces down to Machu Picchu in Peru. Another one out to the Canary Islands, where there's a step pyramid that looks very similar to what I looked at in Corral, which is about 3 hours north of Lima, Peru. And then, of course, this is recent. Dennis Stone tracked one of the other standing stones and wound up right at the tip of the Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau, which is why we call it the Axis Mundi. So it's like, that's a mind blower to me, because that information, no one knew anything about that. And again, that stone, the dedication stone, found at America Stonehenge, lay in the museum for 11 years before Dr. Barry Fell came up and translated it and said, oh, this, it says Tubal of the Canaanites and dedication. And they didn't understand what that was till I told them about the Nephilim. And then, I mean, for me, it's just like, that was, my jaw was on the ground. So it's sort of a toss-up. You know, what we discover with the elongated skulls, in my opinion, is it absolutely 100% definitive? No, it's not. But how much, the evidence, the weight of the evidence, the morphological, structural anomalies in these skulls point to genetics. This is something that's genetic. It's there. It has nothing to do with cranial deformation.
To the phones now we go. David in New York to get us started. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, L.A. I was thinking while I was on hold, because I've mentioned your name before on other broadcasts, and Steve Quayle, and that, you know, I stand on a soldier, or the shoulders of giants, and I just realized, hey, that was a pun. I all those times I said it, I wasn't thinking about Giants in that respect. But in one of your films, it showed that different, like three segments or two segments in the skull, okay, you know what I mean? Not like a regular human skull, but there were, you know, fractures basically in the skull that weren't in a, you know, a natural human type skull. Do you recall anything like that?
Yeah, the which we didn't actually get into, but many of the Paraca skulls, the elongated skulls, do not have a sagittal suture. These sutures are what form in utero, in the womb, and they essentially hold the skull together. For instance, there's the frontal suture, there's the sagittal suture, which runs from the frontal, where your forehead is, all the way back to the rear plate, the occipital plate in the rear. And that sagittal suture splits what's called the two parietal plates on either side of your head. Well, that's what a normal human being has. Well, the Paraca skulls, the suturing is absolutely all wrong. So skeptics will say, well, this could be cranial synostosis. Well, cranial synostosis occurs usually in a very advanced age of a human being, like 70, 80, whatever. And what that happens is the sagittal suture will close. But in these skulls, there's not even a trace of a sagittal suture. It's not there. It's like it was never there. And so this is why, you know, anthropologists and archaeologists who go down there, they're trained, you know, as an archaeologist, they're trained in that discipline. But when you show it to an optometrist, a surgeon, medical doctors, and that's what we show in the film, and these guys are professionals, they're looking at this thing and going, sorry, this is not the result of cranial deformation. You can't do this. The fact that cranial synostosis certainly could be there, but why is it so predominant in the Paracas people? Why is it skull after skull after skull has, cranial synostosis, or is it something else? Are they actually born this way? Is it genetic? Is it a genetic anomaly? And this is why in the trailer, which I think you can see on Coast, you can see all these professionals go, it's genetic. This isn't human. This is a new species. Mm-hmm. It's genetic. You can't do this through cranial deformation.
How big is the elongated skull compared to a normal human skull?
Well, we think in some of these that there's upwards of 25 to 30% larger cranial capacity. We showed that in the film, and that was our first trip down there with Brian Forrester. And we're at the old Paracas History Museum when Senior Wong was still alive. And Brian and I are conversing about this. We're using rice and the weight of the rice and the volume of the rice going into the skulls. And we're A-B-ing it with a normal human being. And the Paracas skulls, the elongated skulls, are about 25 to 30% larger cranial capacity than a normal human being. So this is why they were emulated, as we talked about before the break. This is why people were binding their kids to look like this, because they were probably worshipped as gods. We don't know what capacity they had supernaturally. When I use that, we don't know what they were able to do. Did they have supernatural? Was there a supernatural component to them? In my opinion, there more than likely was, but we don't know what that is because they're not running around today.
Did they have more brain space than a normal human being?
Yes. Yeah, 25 to 30% larger.
Brain, which means they could have been super intelligent, too.
Well, I think they were.
Wow.
Absolutely.
The secrets of the universe right there, huh? Let's go to Ann in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Ann, welcome to the program. First time west of the Rockies. Go ahead.
Thank you. L.A. Marzulli, when I was a kid growing up, I was about 11 and 1969, we had a semi-retired archaeologist called Dr. Green and his wife, and they give seminars, and they had three of those, what they called Nephilim skulls. One of them still had some of the red hair left on it, and he would let those who wanted to hold them. They were very, very heavy. And he had a human skull that he showed us that it absolutely was very, very different and could not have been made by, let's say, alternation by, you know, a board or something. And I also wanted to ask a question. He had other types of skulls that also were not like anything we have today. And one was a round skull with little sharp teeth with two little horns that he called the little devils that they had created these, what he called evil Nephilim. And he also quoted the Bible and other ancient texts. And his name was Dr. Green. He lived on the corner, I believe, of Delaney and Horn in Bay City, Texas. And he died in the early 1970s.
Wow. Do you have any idea of contact information or any, is there any way you can shoot me an email so I can, I'd like to find out who has the artifacts and what happened to them? I mean, I realize that sounds pretty cool.
Long ago. I'm in my 60s now. This was 1969-ish.
Ooh.
His name was Dr. Green, Bay City, Texas. Bay City, Texas. And he lived on the corner of Horn and Delaney.
Might not even be around anymore.
Right. He died in the early 1970s. He was about 83 years old when he died. And his wife was in her early 60s. And she packed everything up and left after that, and I don't know where she went. But we had to get permission from our parents to go there because it said it could scare us. But I thought this was very fascinating because what you're saying is almost exact to what he taught in his seminars.
Very, very interesting. Boy, please shoot me an email with some of that information, if you would. That's la@lamarzulli.net, la@lamarzulli.net. I'd love to pick up the story and talk more about it with you.
Spell your last name for folks too, L.A.
Yeah, M-A-R-Z as in zebra, U-L-L-I, Marzulli.
Great. Ann, thank you. Good to have you on
the
program.
Ann.
Great questions. Next up, we've got time. Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Quick questions. First was the initial when the Nephilim and or giants got together with non-Nephilim woman, did they initially, you think, cohabitate and stay with these women for years? And my second question would be about the Watchers. When you read about the Watchers in Ezekiel, for example, and they're in the Book of Enoch, I would think they were just regular people assigned that role. But maybe they weren't. Maybe they had a different skull formation. Maybe they had supernatural powers that other people didn't have that enabled them to be watchers. So what do you think about that as a possibility?
Well, you know, the Book of Enoch tells us that the watcher angels came down to Mount Hermon, and I'm hoping to mount an expedition, if COVID allows me to, next year with our good friend Mondo Gonzalez and perhaps Derek Gilbert and some others, to get over there and spend like a week up in the Golan, which is Nephilim Central in Mount Hermon, which overlooks it. And the Book of Enoch tells us 200 watcher angels descended on Mount Hermon, a high place, descended. Well, where did they descend from? And that's the $64,000 question. You know, if you hold to my worldview, they're interdimensional entities that are coming from the second heaven. If you hold to, let's say, others, maybe they're interplanetary. Could they be both? You know, we just don't know. We don't have enough information. When was the last time anybody sat down with a watcher angel and said, well, can you tell us exactly, you know, where you're coming, how you get here? And we don't know the answers to that. We just don't know. We can connect some of the dots where, in other words, there seems to be gateways, portals, connectivity, like Axis Mundi, Stonehenge. Why are these standing stones connected to Machu Picchu and Teotihuacan and Chaco Canyon and Stonehenge, England? Why is that there? You know, who would do that 4,000 years ago? It's an impossibility. You have to be in the air. You have to triangulate in the air 4,000 years ago. That was impossible. So watcher angels descended, okay, on Mount Hermon thousands of years ago. And this is the subject of my new book. It's called Countermove. How the Nephilim returned after the flood. That will come out probably around Christmas time, maybe the first of the year. It's finished and it's going to the printer this week, so we'll see what happens with that. But it deals with all this stuff. So I don't think watchers were people. I think watchers were entities that come from in another dimension. In my opinion, they were fallen angels, and they did the unthinkable. They came and cohabited with the women. They took wives and had children by them. These were the men of renown, the Nephilim. And they're doing it because they want to stop what was prophesied over them, that someone's going to come and crush the head of the dragon. Here's something else to think about. America Stonehenge, that entire site, George, is aligned to the constellation Draco, the
wow.
dragon. I mean, it's not a coincidence after a while. You just sit there and you go, oh, my gosh. But all of this has been hidden because no one comes from a biblical worldview and looks at it through a biblical lens. And the moment we do that, it's like a stack of dominoes. Everything just tumbles over. So the watchers, in my opinion, were fallen angels that came down to literally contaminate the bloodline so that Messiah, the one who would redeem all mankind, would never be born.
Harry is a first-time caller in the Big Apple, New York City. Harry, go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. I had a question. You talk about the skulls of these creatures. I was wondering if anybody has any idea what the rest of their body looks like.
Now, that's a great question.
There's an X-ray that we show in the film of a child, very, very thick skull, and our chiropractor, Malcolm Warren, weighs in on that. Very interesting. There was anomalies that he points out in that X-ray. I have seen entire skeletons. They don't have six fingers. There was an entire mummy that was in a private museum where we photographed it, and it was there, but we weren't allowed to take it out or do anything or take any DNA at all. So as far as I know, I have no idea what happened. They're basically shorter than 6 feet. They're like 5'6", 5 foot. They're not giants.
Are they human looking though? They don't have like 20-inch hands or anything like that.
No,
right?
Nothing like that. The basic anomaly so far is the elongation, and of course the very large eye sockets that go with it. We also believe that when they were alive, the cartilage would have been much larger. In other words, the neck would have been somewhat larger than a normal human being.
Skinnier and longer, I guess.
It would be longer.
Yeah. Interesting. And I would guess that most of these skulls had skeletons next to them, right?
Well, you know, this is problematic because a lot of times, especially in Peru, it's the Huacaros, it's the grave robbers who get to these sites first and dig up the stuff. And so they take the gold or the silver or the robes, which are worth $1 million on the black market, and other things like this, and they just you know, throw the bones all over the place. So Julio Teo, in the last century, was the father of Peruvian archaeology, and he was able to go in and actually conduct, bona fide archaeological digs. And what's interesting is they actually unwrapped several mummies in that video, and I've seen that video. It's at the museum. It's absolutely fascinating to look at. We would love, and when I was at the Ica Museum, they showed us a whole racks and racks and racks of skulls. We saw all that. And they also showed us mummies. But very little research is done. There's a very obscure mummy we call the Chudi mummy, which, and this is the story behind that, and my hat's off to Brian Forrester, who pointed that story out to me. But it's called, Dr. Chudi was down in Peru.
Hold on. We'll have you finish that story, L.A., when we come back. Well, this being the Veterans Day night program, of course, next hour, Danion Brinkley joins us. We're going to talk about veterans when we get to the point where we take phone calls in our last hour. I would love those of you who have served or continue to serve to check in with us as well. Tell us a story or two, or some of you can just call Danion with a call or two as well. But our salute to veterans in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll be back in a moment with more with our friend L.A. Marzulli and final calls. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with L.A. Marzulli and your phone calls in L.A. Before we take the final calls here, I want to congratulate you and thank you for the great dedicated work you've done, not only for yourself, but for this program over all the years. I mean, it is truly remarkable.
That means a lot, George. It really does. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
You know, Richard Shaw would have loved to have been on this Paracas trip. Oh, my gosh. He's looking down at you right now going, it's Nephilim.
He's gloating. Who are we kidding?
Where do you, is it expensive to get DNA checked?
Well, I mean, it really isn't. It's thousands of dollars, depending on how far you want to go. To do a whole genome, that's a lot of money. We've never been able to get there because we don't have nuclear DNA. So, again, if there's listeners out there, please shoot me an email, la@lamarzulli.net. We've got samples. We'd love to get them tested, but we don't have a lab who will touch us. And I'm not, I've got a guy that's trying to do it. No one will get near us.
What exactly is nuclear DNA?
Nuclear DNA will give us the other side of the equation. Right now, all we have is the side from the mother's side, the mitochondrial DNA. So our hypothesis would be that the nuclear DNA would show some sort of unknown primate. The work of Dr. Melba Ketchum, for instance, she's done...
Looking for Bigfoot.
Research.
Yeah.
Exactly. She's done extensive research with this. She's had good luck with the DNA. Hats off to Melba and Dr. Ketchum, they are unknown primates. So there it is.
Final calls. Here we go. We are going to Carl in Kitchener, Canada, on the international line. Carl, hi there.
Oh, God bless you, George, L.A. Yeah,
thank
we
you.
Used to be called Berlin World War One. They changed the name because of the war with Germany. I just wanted to say that the fallen angels, they fooled around. I seen a Christian program on TV once. He said the fallen angels fooled around with creation, that there wasn't supposed to be any dinosaurs. And that they were supposed to be, actually in the future, we're supposed to be all vegetarians. It says the lion will lie down with the lamb. That'd be pretty neat to see a lion eating grass in the future.
I love that. So what do you think of that stuff, L.A.?
You know, there's a book I wrote called The Cosmic Chess Match, and the first chapter, my editor said, you can't write this. You're gonna blow yourself out of the water. And what I stated was that the entire dinosaur thing was something literally created by the fallen ones, and that's why it got wiped out. That's conjecture, and I still hold to that. That something's going on here. It's dark. It's ominous. And we don't have all the answers. Nobody does. But that's why we're on the trail.
These fallen angels, biblically speaking, but interpreted for us, in your opinion, what were they?
Well, they seem to be immortal entities. They were worshipped in antiquity as the gods. The Greek pantheon is essentially the Titans. I mean, that's linguistically, you can tie that right back to Satan. They were the fallen ones. But it begs the question, why did they rebel? What's really going on here?
Why were they so ticked off at us, you know?
Exactly. And we know one thing, that they want to be worshipped. We know that. That's the end game. And they want to be worshipped by humans, which is why they set up shop on a global level in different places. And they set up these little kingdoms. And they are worshipped as gods. Just look at the Greek pantheon. Just look at what happened all throughout the Middle East. But also over here in places like Teotihuacan, where they worship Quetzalcoatl. Who the heck was he? And the whole thing just disappears, doesn't it? It's just like this thriving community. And archaeologists go, well, maybe there was a drought. And they all, no one really knows. It's all speculation. But you just don't abandon a place like Teotihuacan because you got a couple of years without rain. You work something out. And they didn't work something out. So I think it's very mysterious.
Karen's with us in New Jersey. Hi, Karen. You're on with L.A. Marzulli.
Hi, George. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
L.A., oh, my God, there's so many questions, but you had mentioned your next book where you would explain who these Nephilim are today. I just wanted to go back a little bit. So the angels saw that the women were beautiful, the daughters of men. That's why they defected. Well, according to the Word of God, there might have been other reasons. But so they made it with the women. They had the Nephilim. So these skulls that you talk about, you're saying that these skulls are the original skulls from the Nephilim from these fallen angels, correct?
No, I think he's saying that they are the offspring of the Nephilim later. But go ahead, LA. I don't want to correct you.
What they are is there are multiple incursions. In other words, you've got the initial incursion where the 200 watcher angels come down on Mount Hermon. The Nephilim are then wiped out. Everything is wiped out except for 8 people. Is that mythos or is it reality? I believe it's real because there's a flood tradition in every culture on the planet. So the bottom line is there are multiple incursions. What the Paraka skulls are, in my opinion, are left over from the conquest 3,500 years ago from Joshua and Caleb when they go into the Promised Land, and guess who's there? And that's a 3-hour conversation because they're there. They're put. The Nephilim tribes are in the Levant, in the Promised Land, because they know that the God of the Bible wants that land for something. They're not sure what for, but that's why they're positioned there.
But these skulls are not straight Nephilim. They're offspring of Nephilim, correct?
No, I would say that they're straight Nephilim.
You do?
One of the tribes, yeah. I think they're either the Anakim or the Horites. I don't know which. And until we get nuclear DNA, we really don't know. We only got half of the equation.
Let's go back to Karen.
Morphological differences.
Karen, you're correct. You want a follow-up question?
Yes, a follow-up question. So when God flooded the earth, he did that because of these offspring that were trying to, well, that would change the bloodline. He wanted to preserve the bloodline
Correct.
So that the Messiah could be born without being tainted. Okay.
Correct.
So that he could make the sacrifice for us who believe. Now, the question is, in that flood, he wiped all those people out except for Noah, his 3 sons, and Noah's wife. But the 3 sons, so those people I just mentioned, their bloodline was not tainted. How did the Nephilim or their bad bloodline continue? Was it because these 3 sons picked wives who may have had tainted DNA?
No, absolutely not. In fact, that's why I wrote the new book, which is coming out. It's called Countermove, How the Nephilim Return in the Flood. And it'll be out, and I don't want to give the punchline away.
Because you'll be back here.
We'll be back here giving the punchline away on Coast. Exactly.
Interesting theories. Gosh, how long have you been doing this?
when I was 16, I read Eric von Däniken's book, 16, 18, right around there. And that changed my life. I wasn't a Christian then, so I looked at it through his lens, his worldview. And then when I was 30, I became born again, spirit-filled, and everything began to change. My worldview began to change. But since I was about 16, 18 years old, fascinated with this stuff, fascinated with it.
You know, it's such a treat to have read von Däniken's book, Chariot of the Gods, and then eventually meet him at a live event, and then get to know him and stay friends with him and have him on the show. I mean, it's bizarre. It really is. Jason in Los Angeles. Take it away, Jace. Go ahead.
Hi, George in L.A. I had a question kind of following up on what you guys were just talking about. So if L.A., if the Anakim were the ones that were in Peru, and they were, do you believe that they were responsible for the sites, the megalithic sites like Sacsayhuaman, Machu Picchu, some of these enormous stones that seem like, they look like marshmallows, the way they're curved, they weigh so much, tons, thousands of tons. Do you think it was them, or was there another group there besides the elongated skull on a key?
I agree with your assessment, what you're proposing. I believe Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, Machu Picchu, when you look at the megalithic, I think it's pre-flood. That's conjecture on my part, but I think it's pre-flood. Something cataclysmic happened on all those sites, which destroyed much of the site. And then later on, the Anakim or these Paraka skulls, whatever you want to call them, we don't know whether they're the Anakim. That's conjecture on my part. But based on everything I know to now, they're either the Horites or the Anakim or maybe some mixture between the two. But Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, Machu Picchu, the ancient megalithic sites, I think that's pre-flood.
Thomas in La Jolla, California. Tom, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, George, and thank you, L.A. Marzulli, for all of your research. You are absolutely the best. You know, you talk about these beings being interdimensional, and that sort of implies that there are portals. And
correct.
What I'm suggesting, L.A., is that the portals and the mating between these interdimensional beings, fallen angels, and human women are invitational. In other words, they are conducted by ritual. And if you'll let me explain a little bit, for example, in modern times, you had Jack Parsons, who was the founder of Jet Propulsion Laboratory,
right.
And he and his wife, through ritual, were trying to open a portal, number one, and two, create a mating between his wife and an interdimensional being to create a moon child. You
correct.
See what I mean? John Dee, in the Elizabethan times under Queen Elizabeth I, you know, was also trying to open up portals through invitation, through ritual, and create a super race, you know, a mating between fallen angel entities and human women. Mm-hmm. The modern SS under Adolf Hitler, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at Wolfsburg Castle, forgive my German pronunciation,
Heidelberg.
But Wolfsburg Castle was a center of ritual mm-hmm. for the Death Head's order of the SS. Same with Aleister Crowley of England. He was trying to open portals through ritual and then create insemination of human women mm-hmm. by entities which would create a, well, how should I say it, a genetically engineered paranormal super race, you know,
mm-hmm.
which we know of as the giants, the Nephilim, you know, the fallen angels, the Canaanites, etc. And I was wondering if you would speculate on that, or if your speculations go that far.
Yeah, let's work backwards. Aleister Crowley indeed do exactly what you're talking about. Wedelsburg Castle, the Hall of the Dead, the elongated skulls, crystal skulls, whatever, the Black Sun. Russ Dizdar was there and actually prayed in that place and broke some of the dark ritual that was done. Jack Parsons, Babylon Working, that's exactly what he was trying to do. There's nothing new here. It's been going on literally for thousands of years. I would even put that a certain gentleman who's very high up in UFO circles is basically doing the same type of thing by inviting the so-called extraterrestrials, and they're showing up. Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, need I say more? And, you know, unless you know what that entity is, why are we inviting these things in? In other words, if someone knocks on your door at 3 o'clock in the morning, you just don't let them in the house, if you get my drift here. So, yeah, I mean, Jack Parsons, Babylon Working, that was a ritual. The Nazis were doing it. Lebensborn, which was the breeding program. Wedelsburg Castle with the Hall of the Dead. The skulls were there. All that. I mean, they know they are a cult. Adepts, they know exactly what they're doing, and that's why they do it.
Hey, L.A., we are running out of time, my friend. When's your next book done?
Probably right around Christmas, George.
Okay, so you make yourself, you schedule with Tom or Lisa and get on the program
sure
with
will.
That, my friend. And one more time, give out your email to folks who want to get a hold of you.
Yeah, we've got a special coast-to-coast sale right on our website, lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.net. You can go to our streaming site, download them, instant gratification, streaming.lamarzulli.net. There are now 6 episodes, including the DNA final result. That's episode 6. So streaming.lamarzulli.net. Thanks so much, George. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, L.A. Continue with the building process. Get you back to California. Up next, Danyon Brinkley joins us, our special tribute to veterans.